Bathrobe's peer Robert Norse. A bit late here today, but actually earlier than I thought, since my car broke down en route to the studio. For the next 2.5 hours, we are hoping to keep you on the dial with Bathrobe's Pier's Broadside, Civil Rights for the Poor here in Santa Cruz. So stay with us.
Fearful times make willing slaves who seek their freedom in their chains. Reagan's election was no surprise. You voted for Nixon twice. Why? Because you're stupid! Stupid! TV preachers quote the Lord. Say, beat your plowshares into swords. Live your life the Christian way. Send them money and you'll be saved. Why?
And that was the San Francisco Mime Troupe, one of my favorite early 80s musical numbers. I always pull these ancient creaky items out from the archives because it's my show, after all. But it's also your show, and we do have a call-in line at 423-5361 if you want to join us. We had originally scheduled a guest, a local woman who's homeless, who was having some problems at Wash Rock Cafe and Laundromat. She was going to talk about that in some detail, and she may still be discussing it at next Tuesday's City Council meeting. And I'm going to hold off on that issue until I hear more from her. I'll actually give you a brief summary of that a bit later in the show. We have lots of stuff happening here today. I've got news items. We've got interviews with Phil Bear on the Beach Flats. Phil Bear heads a group called Frog Broth. Frog Broth is named after the phenomenon wherein you know that a frog will leap out of hot water but will allow himself to slowly be boiled to death if you turn up the heat slowly. And that's what Phil thinks is happening in the Beach Flats with the new redevelopment plans, Third Street realignment, and the stuff that's happening coming up for the City Council that essentially he sees as a giveaway to the Seaside Corporation. And we're hoping to have more people with different points of view. For example, Eric Larson of the Resource Center for Nonviolence. We've invited him to talk on the air. He hasn't accepted yet, so we'll see if that happens. And of course, your opinions are of interest to all of us. Today, I want to remind you, is also the day that the Sleeping Ban Initiative, the initiative to repeal the sleeping sections of the city's camping ban, begins. We actually have the petitions in hand. We're going to be training people into how to use them. And you can actually go today at 1 o'clock this afternoon to 706 Frederick Street and get that kind of training from the Committee to Repeal the Sleeping Ban. 706 Frederick Street, which is on the east side at Frederick and Soquel, very close to Soquel Avenue. So, hey, come on down. We can use all the help we can get to end this unjust law, which makes it illegal for anyone to sleep in a vehicle or outside in Santa Cruz after 11 o'clock at night. This in a situation where there are shelter spaces in the winter for less than 150 and in the summer for less than 40 for a population of 500 to 1,500 homeless people. But I'm going to begin the show with a special vote of thanks to a man who I'm not going to name on the air. He prefers to remain anonymous. He's an anonymous Good Samaritan, and I'm not going to talk in great detail about the kind of work he does, though he discussed that with me, and it is a form of caregiving work. He actually helped many people after the earthquake, and that gave him some great satisfaction. But he has some ideas he wants to put out on the air regarding solutions to the problems of poverty and famine, which I guess struck him when a massive famine hit Korea several months ago, was it, Joe?
Yes, it was approximately 3 months ago mm-hmm. when I learned that 1 million people were going to die in North Korea with no assistance. I guess the justification from the United States and the United Nations was that any assistance rendered to North Korea would end up in the hands of the military and wouldn't go towards the cause. I didn't really understand that. I think that the assistance should have been rendered, even if it was to go to the military. At least we'd make our best attempt to save some of those people. It led me to a thought of possibly a solution, and the solution has to do within our economy. The way I arrived at this is another story, but it had to do with building as a foundation, like you would any project. If you were building a house, you would look first, well, where you're going to pour the foundation. You would look and make sure there were no rotting or decaying stumps or something like that that might cause the soil to dip a little bit after you poured your foundation and cause the house to be a little bit on tilt years after. So I tried to look at the problems and find a solution and start from the cause. But what I've come up with is an idea that if we talk to industry, labor, and government and propose that all three could have exactly what they want. That in itself would be the solution. The industry in this country, if you were to think of what they want, and let's use, for instance, a motor company that maybe makes cars, and what they would want is, they would want raw materials to go in the front of the factory, and they would want a finished automobile to come out the other end, with robotics in between, and with no workforce, if possible. And if you look at labor, what they would want, or what I would want, or what we would want, it would be to have the maximum benefits, maybe the least amount of hours to work. It would be to have total job assurance, be working in a position that we would love to work. And if I look at government, I see that in the purest sense, what they would want would be enough revenue to exact a solution to the problems that they have. And I don't think it's really that their agenda is to keep over-governing and cutting our rights, but it's an agenda of filling the needs of all these different causes that come up and not being able to do it in a proper manner. Well, my solution would be an agreement between industry and labor. And the way that this would come about would be that labor would agree to install the machinery that industry desires for their assembly lines, for their production, and that industry would supply the machines, and then labor would maintain them. And what this would do for industry is it would basically allow the owners of these companies to walk away from their factories and allow them to work under automation and to be able to turn a dial and govern their assembly production by, if Ford wanted to make 10 million cars a year, or if they wanted to make 40 million, it would be within a turn of the dial. And that's what they want. They want to be able to do that. Now, how would you compensate labor for their effort in this? I'd propose that for every item that was produced, that there would be a book time that would be assessed to that. For instance, if there was a Blazer built out of Ford or Chevy, that industry would hire a number of workers that were very efficient, and they would have them assemble that automobile by hand, and they'd have them somewhat perfect their ability to do that. And once that was established and they built a car, then labor would come and look at the car and make sure it was up to the standards of what GM wanted. And then at that time, that book time, or how many hours it took to produce that car, would be the amount of credit that would be sent towards labor or a labor union. That would give a compensation for every item that was built not only at GM, but throughout all industry, and a share of profit, that because the profit level would be astronomical for GM or Ford if they were working in such a way that production was no longer the abusive arena that it is now. It would be a very pure environment that would not tax anybody to work within. And what this would do is it would eliminate jobs, a little different than what we're thinking about now, increasing jobs. It would make it so that as a worker in the union, your job would be to be trained at any position that you were going to work at the highest level of technological training. and to do that job the best way possible. And with in mind, trying to make the job obsolete.
So let me ask you a couple questions
here. Okay.
Joe, who would have control over the management decisions around this?
That would be the owners of industry. They would dictate what they wanted in their factory, and it would be up to the labor force to implement that and put it in place.
Now, by the labor force, you're aware that there is, of course, a significant cutback in the union movement in this country, and indeed, a lot of us are concerned that multinational corporations are simply removing their factories to cheap arenas where they can, like China and the Philippines and Mexico, where they can use masses of cheap labor, produce products for virtually nothing with environmental laws down to zilch. How would your system deal with these concerns?
Within the way that things are working right now, industry and labor really have a stranglehold on each other. What industry wants to perform, labor won't allow, and what labor wants, industry won't allow. That being that there's a stranglehold, basically, from labor to industry, where, for instance, Ford has 10 to 15% robot. I'm not really sure on the numbers, but it's 10 to 15% robotics that are allowed in their factory. And if they want to put another machine in, and it's not within the labor contract, there'll be a walkout. And not only a Ford, but the United Auto Workers. Because with the event that machines were to replace more people, there'd be a loss of jobs. And when you look at labor, when they ask for a raise, this goes to the highest courts to exact a quarter, a nickel an hour raise. It's a lot of money. But now, if you give labor exactly what they want, and you give industry exactly what they want, I doubt if they'll go anywhere else to find something better.
I think let's the lines are open, by the way, for anyone who wants to call in and engage in some kind of commentary or dialogue on this issue with Joe here. Phone number, of course, for those of you who've forgotten or whatever, is 423-5361. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is a little bit of a sort of a step away from what we normally do in this show, but issues of the global economy naturally have an impact on folks who are outside and folks who are poor. My concern about this kind of issue would always be, as I said before, labor union proportions have dropped, I don't know, it's 15% or less and dropping, and the number of folks who are unionized in this country. Most people don't have a significant say in their job conditions, and most of those decisions are made by people with money. And the question to me has always been, the reason that these famines, I think, that you're talking about, Joe, are created, have to do with international finance organizations that put strangleholds on third world country economies, demanding they engage in austerity programs that involve, for example, in the export of food to other countries when they can't even feed their own, or alternately, the import of food into third world countries that destroys the native food industry, like in Guatemala, for instance, has been happening recently. Any thoughts on that?
Yes. I believe that the oppression that is put upon people because of the threat of war, or the threat of famine, or the threat of just not being able to take care of your family, leads us to go in directions that we would not go in. I believe that if given a chance, that we all could work together. And I don't believe this is my plan. I believe this is the original plan. And that if we were to look at the problems of the world and try to find a solution collectively that worked for everybody, I am confident that we could create a utopia, not only in the United States, but in the world, and that the brilliance that we have, the gifts just talking to Robert for just the moment that I met him, I could tell that he has a brilliance in his life that's shining. And the reason that
this man is sharp,
the reason that I see that is that he's doing something that he loves to do, and that's to assist people that are needy. And if Robert was working for a Fortune 500 company and he was bringing in a whole wad of cash every month and driving a Lexus, he could come home to his family and really have a good time, but he might not have that brilliance.
But if any Fortune 500 companies are listening, do give a call to 423-5361.
Yeah, see, we're all interested in feathering our nests, and that's part of our nature. But what we're facing right now is not only homelessness, but we're facing global threats that are so wicked in nature that if we were to focus on them for any length of time at all, it would be maddening. For instance, that famine that we were talking about, and what an atrocity to think of a million people, a community, dying without assistance.
You know, let me draw this kind of closer home to Santa Cruz. Of course, I think that the global perspective is an important one. I also think your focus on a potential utopia is really important, because I tend to agree with you. I think utopia is a lot closer than most of us are aware of. Of course, it involves the decisions of several billion people, but sometimes those decisions can be made very quickly once an idea begins to spread. In Santa Cruz, we have a situation, I guess, across the state and the nation, because of the cutbacks in the welfare net. You have increasing food lines in different cities, increasing hunger, and this has been reported by the organization Food Not Bombs in different cities. What do you think, Joe? You're talking about an idea that folks can grapple with, although some, for example, they give the critical side of it, the idea of industry, government, labor cooperation, of course, was one of Mussolini's key ideas. I don't know if you know that. It was he established a grand fascist council in order to unite these different aspects of divergent fighting groups that he thought should all get together and join hands. Of course, what happened was the men with the money pretty much controlled what went on, and business went on as usual, but the government had more power and the labor unions were crushed. What would be a way to avoid that happening again?
Well, along with Mussolini, there was also a fella in 1887. His name was Edward Bellamy, and he wrote a book.
Looking forward. Yes. Or was it looking backward?
It was looking backward.
Right.
And there's a commentary in the book that it was the single most inspirational piece of American literature on American society. And what it spoke about was a utopia. It was about a man that fell asleep in 1887, and he awoke in the year 2000 to a utopia. And it was explained to him how this state of living had come about. And he was walked backward through the events that dictated this change. And there are some comments about different areas in the book that seem to be a little burdensome on society, and it has been critiqued through the years. But what I would like to say on that note is that this was a book that was really looked at with a lot of thought on could it work. But now here's a man that was living in 1887 that wrote this book, and you look at the society that we have today and the advancements, and to see his plan is to realize that it can work, and we have sight now in our consciousness on what we're able to do. He was prophesizing of what would come about they didn't have digital radio back then. He prophesized it. Clock radio. He prophesized before radio came out. Well, now we have it.
You know, it's interesting. You want to contrast the 1880s with the 1990s. There's always, the question of, we of course have great technological marvels that they didn't have in the 1880s. We also have massive cancers, pollutions, and threats to the environment that nobody could have dreamed of in the 1880s, and destruction of the family system that nobody saw in the 1880s. And I'm not saying that things haven't improved in many respects. And the idea is to draw together the best aspects of all these things. But again, the primary concern to me seems to be that there are those in power who have the wealth, who have the privileges, who have the systems in place that keeps going what they want going. And the idea that they will voluntarily step aside because of a vision of plenty for the many. It seems to me, you know, when folks start making money, they like making money. It becomes a kind of a sickness. That's why people like to be billionaires. Nobody can use billions of dollars. Nobody can use millions of dollars. But they like to make more and more and more. I'm going to have to kind of wind this down. Let me have you kind of give a concluding statement on these thoughts, Joe. And I'm hoping that we can get you back on the air talking more about local issues as well, because I know you've had a lot of hands-on experience with local folks, particularly older folks. And I know that's of interest to those of us who are concerned about, for example, the position of old folks on the streets who are out there here in Santa Cruz, who are facing anti-homeless laws that make it illegal to sit down, make it illegal to ask peacefully for spirit change, make it illegal to sleep at night. But why don't you kind of summarize what you want to get out here, and I want to thank you, and then I'm going to move on to the next segment.
Okay. Well, as far as the wealthy people in this nation, and why would they be willing to change? The reason I believe they would is that they're being held hostage by their position in this world too, just as are the homeless people. They aren't free. You see them living in armed camps with the gates around their houses, and they don't have freedom. They have to they have fear not only that they may lose their wealth and end up in the position of a homeless person, but fear of reprisals. The last three presidents of Exxon have had devastation in their families and lives, basically because of the position that they have in industry. Now, if there was a change where there was affluence within our whole nation, and I believe that what I have just mentioned would exact that, because there would be a tremendous wealth that would occur for all workers, everybody in the union, because we'd be tied into not only a book time on products that were being produced, but a share of profit from industry. And what that would give us would be a tremendous income in a society that we could afford the material things that we need to get on with our lives, and not to live abase, but to abound. And also what it would do is it would give the income that would generate more purchasing from industry. So the increased products would also be consumed by the workforce.
Wow. Looks like our phone line is not working too well at the moment. Maybe we can get some speedy assistance from someone within shouting range. That's really, you know, I mean, I'm impressed with, well, visions of utopia impress me, and I like to think we can do something around those issues. I don't know if... I think you're right in some sense that wealthy people are in these armed camps, but whether they're willing to and somehow give it up, that's really the question I have. I don't know what the answer to that is, and I guess for those of you who are listening and trying to call in, and maybe our phone lines are fixed now, I'm hoping, give a call to 423-5361. I'm not sure if Joe's going to stay around or not. He was graceful enough and helpful enough and there at the right time and gave me a ride down to the station when my car broke down. And I think he probably has a schedule he has to move on with. But if you have comments on what he has said, you can give me a call at the headquarters for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and I will pass on your comments to Joe later. He can call in and give us some thoughts. And that number is 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, 423-HUFF, or 423-4833. I'm now going to try to answer this phone call, caller, and we'll see if we can actually get you on the air.
Hi there, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, I was just calling to make sure the phone line's working.
The phone line is working. I want to thank you for your good work, repairman.
All right. Hey, Lobo, get over here!
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So I want to thanks again, Joe, and we'll advise you as to what's coming on in terms of any response. This is Super Bowl Sunday, so who knows what kind of audience we have today. But I really appreciate you coming in.
I'd like to see John Elway win the Super Bowl today.
I see. And there you have an unpaid commercial comment.
The last statement that you made, Robert, about rich people doing away with something, I would like to say that it wouldn't be that they would lose anything. What they would do is they would have great gain, like everybody else, because their industry then would thrive. They would be able to exact technological changes that would be, it would set technology free, and the workers in this country would be going in a direction not that mandated a certain income, but it would be that of love, and so their brilliance would shine like yours does. They would
Which
be going
is pretty damn bright. I want to make a note right now.
Right, because how many people do you know out there that have fantastic gifts that in no way at all do they use those other than just within their family or just within their block or their school that they don't, for instance, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, the top 2-3% of the graduating class go into law. Law is exciting. It's a thrilling thing, but then you see alcoholism. And you see drug abuse, and you see divorce, and you see destruction in these people's lives. And not all. You know, some really love what they're doing, and that's the direction they'd love to go. But within that, there are navigators there. There are preachers and pastors and people that would love to go in that direction, and their brilliance is never seen in the direction of their passion.
I think that is the key criticism of capitalism, and state socialism as well, at least as it's been, practiced in the Soviet Union and in China, that people are in compulsory situations and that, well, actually, it's a combination of criticisms. But I want to thank you, Joe, for being on the air. And I encourage anyone who has any thoughts on this to give a call to 423-HUFF. And I invite Joe to call that number later if he wants to see if anybody has called in. You can all do that, folks, if you have a telephone and you have any thoughts on this. And stay with us for the next portion of Bathrob Spears Broadsides. You're at 96.3 FM.
You hear so many rumors, sometimes you get confused. But I read it in Time magazine, and I heard it on the news. We'll see dramatic changes in the lifestyle we enjoy. If those megatons of atom bombs are active, the scenarios are scary, oh, but they don't worry me, since I received a pamphlet from a federal agency. It's got diagrams and checklists, and I read it front to back, and it told me what to do in case of nuclear attack. Just dig up open ground, climb right on down, lay some boards on top of you and sprinkle dirt around. You have to be dead if you only plan ahead. You'll be glad you kept the shovel on hand. Now you can't just go picking any old place to dig your hole. Got to take a ride to the countryside, to the town where you are told. If your plates are odd numbered, please don't panic, you'll be fine. Just politely let those even numbered cars go first in line. If you don't have a car, just hail a cab or ride your bike. You can climb aboard the Amtrak train, sit back, enjoy the sights. You and thousands of your city friends will be welcomed cordially by townfolk who will show you country hospitality. Then dig a hole in the ground, climb right on down. Lay some boards on top of you and sprinkle dirt around. You wouldn't have to be dead if you only plan ahead. You'll be glad you kept the shovel on hand. We're sure to give you notice up to 7 days before, but it's wise to recognize the warning signs of nuclear war. If the temperature is rising in a flash of blinding light, grab your toothbrush and a flashlight and shut the windows tight. If the wind is blowing wicked and there's buildings in the air, blisters on your body, fire in your hair, if the Tupperware is melting and your dinner plans are wrecked, stay calm. Time to put this foolproof plan into effect. Just dig a hole in the ground, climb right on down, place some boards on top of you and sprinkle dirt around. You won't have to be dead if you only plan ahead. You'll be glad you kept the shovel on hand.
Let's dig it one more time.
A hole in the ground.
This is not a test. Implement emergency preparedness plan immediately. Repeat, this is not a test. Implement emergency preparedness plan immediately. Attention, this is not a test.
Not a Test with Fred Small and his album Heart of the Appaloosa. Again, another classic from the early 80s and still relevant. Well, we're going to leave the higher reaches, the broader perspective, and get down to the details now. Tuesday, every second and fourth Tuesday in Santa Cruz, as most of you listeners may already know, is Santa Cruz City Council time, which means we get to sit there and watch them make their decisions, occasionally yapping a bit at them as they go. And this Tuesday is no exception. That'll be the 27th of January. They have two sessions, one at 3:30 in the afternoon, the other at 7. And both those sessions are in the Santa Cruz City Council chambers across from the Public Library and the Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium at 809 Center Street. I've looked at the agenda, which you can look at yourselves if you look online. There's an HTTP site, and if you want that site, give me a call at 423-HUFF. Leave me a message, and I'll call you back and let you know what it is. You can also go down to the library today or tomorrow or the next day and read the agenda and even see the agenda packet, which you can't get online. So that if you want to inform yourself around those issues before the City Council meeting, you can do that. And if you have any comments to make to council members, you can make them today by calling them at 429-3550. There's a 24-hour message line that's open for incoming calls. The things that have attracted my attention coming up at this next City Council meeting are numerous, and I'm also hoping that our council watchdog, David Silva, Green Party candidate who gave me a call earlier in the show off-air, will call back and give me his thoughts on what he thinks is worthy of our attention on this council agenda. Coming up in the afternoon session, again, which starts at 3:30, under the communications from council members section, which is item 10, there's going to be a resolution appointing representatives to other agencies and groups, such as the Criminal Justice Council and the Santa Cruz Winter Shelter Advisory Committee of the county. Michael Hernandez, one of my least favorite council members, is going to be up for grabs on that issue, and I can't make a lot of intelligent statements about it. I just noticed it on the agenda. I don't quite know what these two committees do. I know the Criminal Justice Subcommittee was the committee that originally gave us the county youth curfew, which became the city youth curfew, which is currently in effect all over, which now is the river and park all-night adult curfew. So we've got curfews up the yin-yang. And Michael Hernandez has never been one to deny the police what they want. He's something of a cheerleader for police power. Ironically, he got his stepping stool to power through the Citizens Police Review Board, which is supposed to be reining in, controlling, monitoring the police, and dealing with police abuses, something that I'm afraid that he didn't do too much of on that board. And, of course, he was appointed by the mastermind of the Citizens Police Review Board, Council Member Scott Kennedy. Kennedy is, as you know, the man behind the Celia Scott purge, attempted purge of Celia Scott from the mayoral position earlier this year, which didn't go through, but just failed by one vote. Rotkin jumped back the other way. Councilmember Rotkin, former Mayor Rotkin, let them sleep in Miami, but not in Santa Cruz, Rotkin. So this item on the agenda is appointing Hernandez, I believe, to two commissions, Criminal Justice Council and Shelter. I suppose it's always good when a council member can educate herself or himself on these issues. And certainly, God knows, Councilmember Hernandez needs education. So, don't know what to say about that. That's 10A on the afternoon agenda. You can, however, talk about Hernandez's actions, if you want, at this particular time. Talk about whether he would be suitable, what you think should be done in terms of shelter needs in the city and county. And, of course, the shelter needs are enormous. I don't really so much go into the shelter needs here, except to note that they are completely inadequate. But there are others who are concerned about that, and if there isn't adequate shelter, then why should people be criminalized for not having it, is, of course, the basic question. We can ask Councilmember Hernandez if he's willing to bring this position to the county's shelter body, or whether he feels that the sleeping ban is a fine thing, as he seems to have said before. Yeah, that there's no problem with the sleeping ban, that he has no problem in keeping the law as it is, making it a criminal to cover up with blankets or sleep, fall asleep outside or in a vehicle in Santa Cruz. That's 3:30 on Tuesday. Then the next thing coming up is a resolution of support. This is a positive thing for the Women and Men's Alliance for Medical Marijuana, WAM, introduced by Mayor Scott and Council Member Rotkin. Resolution supporting the activities of this alliance and declaring the value of service to the community of seriously ill people in the city of Santa Cruz, and to direct that copies of the resolution be sent to federal and state government officials listed in the resolution. Sure, that sounds good to me. I actually clapped when Rotkin made this suggestion at the last council meeting. It would be even nicer if we could have something like Berkeley has had for 20 years, which is making marijuana enforcement the lowest priority in the city. I'm sure Rotkin could do that if he wanted, but for some reason he never has. Perhaps he could get it together to do that. I would like to see that would be something more substantial, not simply a kind of a, oh, please, state and federal authorities, don't come in and bust us. At the same time as Rotkin and the other council members are funding a police department that cooperates fully in these efforts to entrap people in the beach areas and along the river with bogus and intensified so-called drug busts that goes after young people and old people and everybody for using marijuana and smoking marijuana and selling marijuana downtown and in other areas, we don't see any action to deal with these kinds of institutionalized, self-perpetuating, in fact, self-aggrandizing abuses. Instead, we see little token gestures for politically correct positions. Not that WAM isn't a very good organization to support, or the Santa Cruz Cannabis Resource Center, I think it's now called, previously the Cannabis Users Club. Hey, you know, good for them, but realize what they're not doing. That's the most important thing to understand, because what we want to do is get a council in there that really does something and doesn't just pretend to do something while giving the town away to the Seaside Company and redeveloping it all to hell, which seems to be the concern of the council minority right now, as Celia Scott and Catherine Byers are the lone voices talking out on that issue. And even though we thought that the entire council was elected by SCAN and the students and progressives all around the city that had those priorities uppermost, looks like Kennedy, Matthews, and Hernandez and Rotkin have run away in the other direction. The question is, we can allow that to happen. Are we going to kick those turkeys out? The answer, my friends, is up to you. Then, this on the city council meeting, 3:30 Tuesday, on the 27th, still in the afternoon session, is a strange item about, that's 10D, sponsoring a visit from the training ship Golden Bear. Now, I don't know what this is. Is it a restaurant, Golden West, on the ocean? Is it a, you know, is it a strange gold-plated animal? I'm not quite sure what the hell this is, but it says it's a ship. So, you know, I remember back in 1989 when the Resource Center for Nonviolence and Doug Rahn and Scott Kennedy, and there was a huge fight in the city council over whether to allow the Navy ship to come. And they voted against the Navy ship. I remember it particularly well because I was arrested at that city council meeting in another issue, which was the fact that they were not providing any shelter for homeless people, even less than they are now, and arresting people. And it was the coldest, one of the coldest nights of the year. And it was February of 1989. Mayor Wormhout at that time actually had a homeless person arrested who came to her door and slept on it looking for blankets for the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program. That was Freeheart Fran Rizzo, who engaged in that courageous action, and I don't know what we call it, Marty Wormhout. A lot of people had some very nasty names for her. Now she's a county supervisor and supposedly has reformed. I don't know. On those issues, she's never really talked to me about whether she feels it was a wonderful thing arresting all those folks for serving free food or whether it was a mistake, but she has never publicly disavowed her actions, and I'm still waiting for that to happen. I'd like to see that happen. Although she has supported reining in the helicopters in the county, she has given some support to welfare rights, although I understand not much to the attempt to attack this new welfare decapitation that's been going on. Anyway, a training ship, Golden Bear, is apparently being, someone wants to sponsor it. Who wants to sponsor it? Hernandez, Matthews, and surprise, surprise, Vice Mayor Scott Kennedy. This is the Resource Center for Nonviolence co-founder sponsoring a ship. Now, I wonder if this ship has anything to do with the military? Perhaps not. I mean, I'm ignorant of the subject, but somebody clue me in. Anybody know what the Golden Bear training ship is? Let me know. Redevelopment agency then meets at 5 o'clock. That's the same, really, the city council acting as a redevelopment agency, and you can kind of go directly from one meeting into the other. It's all in the same place at City Hall downtown Tuesday. And they are going to, quote, reaffirm the action taken on September 23rd, 97, direct staff to revise relocation guideline, blah, 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 blah. It's about displacing people from properties in the Beach Flats area. That's clearing the folks out to make way for Seaside Corporation businesses and parking lots. Probably worth looking into, folks. 5 o'clock, Santa Cruz City Council, Tuesday. Then in the evening, there is not much on the agenda. Usually there's bunches of public hearings and ordinances, not much happening. But there are two things happening that interest me. One is the reappearance of the disgraceful recommendations from the Citizens Police Review Board on the shooting of Happy John Dine. You may remember this issue. For those of you who have forgotten, Happy John was a disabled person shot dead by Officer Connor Carey November 12th. Two bullets to the gut at Front and Soquel in front of Coast Federal Bank in the evening. He allegedly was, well, depends on what version of the police story you want. If you talk to Chief Belcher and District Attorney Art Danner, read their initial recommendations and their final report, they say that Happy John Dine was pointing a toy gun, what turned out to be a toy gun, at officers Carey and Over. He was threatening them. He had a combat stance, and so he was shot dead by Officer Carey, the driver of the police car that arrived, with Catalyst bouncer Ben Newman sitting in the back, having complained that he had earlier seen or received complaints that Happy John Dine was brandishing a weapon up around right across the street from the Catalyst. Anyway, Dine was shot dead. Officer Carey shot him, and Officer Over had his gun out, and Ben Newman was either crouching in the back of the car or watching intently, depending on which version of his own testimony you want to believe. And that testimony, if you have any doubts, can be found in the public library, thanks to Mayor Celia Scott. the district attorney's report. It's sitting there in the reference section of the main public library if you want to view it. I encourage you all to go down there and check it out. Anyway, the accounts of the police officers and their witness, Ben Newman, differed so markedly from all the other witnesses, and those included 10 that were in the DA's report, 9 or 10, and 6 or 7 others that we found that weren't in the DA's report, who said that Happy John Dine had nothing in his hand, he had nothing pointed to the police, he didn't assume a threatening position, he didn't assume a combat stance. 3 eyewitnesses called the police action murder: Stacy Buckaloo, Mike Schultz, and Murphy, Tom Murphy. So there's a considerable difference of opinion. One would have thought this would be the basis for an independent investigation, or at least public hearings where the witness's testimony was reexamined, a close inspection of the radio tapes of the police cars and so forth. But no, the DA didn't bother to look at those radio tapes, and the Citizens Police Review Board apparently didn't bother to do too much around that either, because when we got the tape through attorney Ed Fry's help, they had erased everything but a few, I guess it's, I'm not sure how many minutes after the man had already been shot. So we don't know what transpired earlier. There's all kinds of gaps in this case. There's 3 witnesses saw Officer Over drawing what appeared to be an object from Dine's clothing and throwing it to the ground, and that was later where the toy gun was found. Something that didn't fit in too well with the district attorney police chief Steve Belcher's claim that that Dine was holding out this weapon and pointing it at both officers, and that was why he was shot. Now, the Citizens Police Review Board came up with its own conclusions, and that was about 2 weeks ago Monday, after refusing to hold public hearings, refusing to hold any kinds of hearings for 2 months. Then they finally went into secret session, I should say closed session. I mean, we knew they were meeting. Wasn't a secret, but we had no input into their discussion, no insight into their mental processes, no opportunity to see the witnesses examined, and they didn't either. They didn't take that opportunity. And they then decided, well, it wasn't that Dine was pointing a gun, he was reaching for a gun. And this, in fact, was the story that Officer Carey originally gave to the police, although not the one that Police Chief Belcher and District Attorney Art Danner chose to believe and promulgate widely, print up on both their final reports. The claim that Carey had was that he saw him reaching for a gun. So don't reach for your keys or your wallet, folks, if you're around an officer. Or if you do and get shot dead, don't expect the Citizens Police Review Board to do anything, the mayor to do anything, the police chief to do anything, the sentinel to do anything. You'll probably get some support from 25 street activists, and possibly the City on a Hill Press, because that's the one area where last week an editorial appeared attacking the Citizens Police Review Board, not even attacking their conclusions, but attacking their process, because they had a private, closed, rubber stamp process, and that is really the disgrace. And what's become an increasingly familiar situation, this so-called progressive board, created as a fig leaf by Scott Kennedy and his council majority, has, well, inadequate power to begin with, and then they don't use the power they have. They have the power to call public hearings, subpoena witnesses, subpoena evidence. They have the power to request to the city manager independent investigation, or even early independent investigation. They don't do that either, in the most serious case in a decade to come along in Santa Cruz. They're a useless group, folks. And that's interestingly brought out in the SCAN newsletter. SCAN newsletter has lots of discussion of that, for those of you who are interested. SCAN is the organization that actually elected these suckers way back when. And, of course, I don't have the SCAN newsletter with me. My production manager and I were running around this morning trying to get things together, and we didn't get everything together. And actually, I'm lucky to be here at all because, as you know, my poor car is coughing and gasping and not getting me where it needs to get me. But anyway, we're talking about the Tuesday City Council meeting. And the Tuesday City Council meeting in the evening has these recommendations from the Citizens Police Review Board coming up. What they ended up saying was, they didn't ask, when should police shoot people dead on the streets? When should they isn't it strange they don't call for backup? Shouldn't they look into the policy guidelines of, don't they usually kind of approach cautiously behind their car doors? Is there any history of bigotry or hostility toward the homeless involved in this kind of activity, which is was a question in a lot of our minds? No, no. The recommendations that the Police Review Board gave and that are coming onto the City Council agenda are, how are officers identifying and handling mentally and emotionally disabled individuals? How are they integrating into the downtown area, which has a lot of emotionally disturbed individuals? What happened in the case of the Borden Care Home, or the mental health home, actually the developmentally disabled home that took care of John Dine? How could they let him come downtown with a toy gun? What about an ordinance for controlling those realistic toy guns? So we don't want to control our police. We want to control those mentally crazy people that the police just happen to be shooting down, and make sure they don't get those toy guns. You know, it makes me so pissed that I kind of want to recommend everybody just wear a toy gun on their belt downtown. I suppose that sounds like a suicidal suggestion, but I mean, it enrages me. It would be a statement to the public if everybody packed a toy revolver, packed a toy pistol. And I just love to see cops stopping people and checking them for their toy guns, because it would keep the issue alive. So I don't know. Call in to hear to the show. Tell me what you think of this idea. We got open lines. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3, 423-5361, here in the studio, 423-5361. Lines are open. I believe the phone's working. We've determined that. So let's hear from you on this thought. Is this a suicidal idea? Should we all be wearing cap guns downtown? Tell me what you think. Anyway, that's item 15 on the evening agenda, and Tuesday is these totally bogus recommendations from the Citizens Police Review Board. And then the next item, item 16, is an update on the Citizens Police Review Board's policies and procedures. It suggests the council review the status reports and provide any comments and suggestions for Citizens Police Review Board consideration. Now, I've always been one that said the council should strengthen the board. The council should, for example, change the standard of evidence in terms of what amount of evidence is required for a complaint to be sustained against a police officer. Well, on the board, it's a preponderance of the evidence, which is 51%. But in the police department, it's what's called clear and convincing evidence, which is more like 80 or 90%, not quite as high as reasonable doubt, the amount of evidence you need in a court to convict someone of a crime. But a significant difference. So when the police review board says, the officer is guilty because there's 51% of the evidence that says so, Police Chief Belcher sort of turns around and says, no, we have a different standard, therefore he's not guilty, or she's not guilty. Not good. And the council has just sat on this one for years. I've suggested that it deal with that issue. It should deal with the issue of Belcher's unilateral changing of the inquiry complaint process. He concealed complaints throughout the summer of 1995 by calling them inquiries in clear violation of the law that set up the Citizens Police Review Board and of his own departmental directive as well. The board said nothing about this, really, and the city council has done nothing about this, and the situation continues. Our city is still using pepper spray, which has been lethal in more than 30 cases nationwide. Actually, I think it's a greater number than that. Maybe it's 30 cases in California. Really heated issue on the Berkeley City Council, but one which we can't get our CPRB to even do a hearing on. Not interested. Sorry. Too busy. The chair of the CPRB has been reelected. The same guy who smiled amicably, pat us on the heads, and told us everything was fine on the Happy John Dine case. We don't need public hearings. We don't need independent investigation. Bill Christie, back at the helm again, steering the ship right out to sea. Very deep waters. So anyway, these things are coming up on Tuesday evening, and of course at 7 o'clock on Tuesday evening you can always come and speak at the oral communications period. And the significant point here is not so much that you can talk to the council. I don't think they care what you have to say. and you probably can say it much better in writing and over the phone to them, get them to talk to you directly. But the public can hear you, not just the 20, 30, 40 people who show up in the audience, but the TV audience, because this goes out on community television. And occasionally the media, although media mischief maker Karen Clark has never been terribly interested in issues of police abuse or issues of homeless rights or even issues of tenants losing their homes in the beach flats. If you view her treatment, things are just rolling right along and couldn't be better. So there is that problem. So it looks like it's time for callers to call in, particularly our council watcher, David Silva. He should be calling in very soon. Maybe I'll have to call him and give him a piece of my mind, ask him what he's up to. Or perhaps what we can do instead, and unless I get a call in shortly, and the call-in number here is 423-5361, as you may know, or should know now, 423-5361. I gave a call the other day to the Berkeley Police Review Commission, which is actually the granddaddy of all police review boards in California, and actually a much stronger board than one we have here. Still considered by activists up there to be pretty pathetic for a number of reasons, and you'll hear that in the interview. It certainly beats our board down here by a factor of 10.
They still have their problems.
Police departments, they get stonewalled by the city manager, and they haven't got any disciplinary powers, and their staffing has been cut way back. But we talked to the chair of that board, Aaron Handel, in a lengthy interview. Aaron is also a former activist, so there's something. It's really hard to find any activists on the police review board who are doing anything at all. We had John Malkin, who actually helped form the board back in the early 90s. He was on the coalition to establish the police review commission, but he quit because he thought the board was ineffective because he was being harassed by police chief, by the officers, by investigations of his political views. Supported by the board, and he actually publishes an interesting letter on that issue.